Critical Theory in Context.
Welcome to Critical Theory in Context, the podcast of the Center for Social Critique at Humboldt University Berlin. I am Jacob Blumenfeld. Today in the studio, I have as my guest Aaron Beninov, who came to Berlin to give one of the keynotes at our conference on the rationality and pseudo-rationality of planning. Aaron is an assistant professor in the Department of Global Development at Cornell University. His research spans a variety of topics, including automation, unemployment, the history of social and economic development, critical theory, and alternative economic systems. His first book was Automation and the Future of Work, was published by Verso in 2020. It's been translated into 10 languages. He recently published a two-part long-form article in the New Left Review called Beyond Capitalism, which we'll discuss shortly below. Welcome to the podcast, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I want to start by talking about this question of the future. Now, critical theorists have been trained to criticize things, right? To criticize capitalism, right? That is our role. We know how to criticize, spelled out to give calls on conceptual stories. A lot of critical theorists see this as a development of Marx's original critique of utopian socialism, right? The idea that we should have utopian visions of the future, just draw them out, make all these plans for what we should do each day, where we should sit, was seen as a bit naive and romantic, idealistic. Marx's project of a critique of political economy was to stick to the real social and economic relations that were limiting freedom in the world, exploiting people. And by giving a critique of these relations, we could develop the space for people to decide themselves on the future without any technocrats or dictators telling them how the future should be. Adorno and Horkheimer and others in the 20th century developed this idea into what they called the Bilderverbot, which was a ban on the images of the future. They thought, you know, like in the Old Testament, there should be a ban on images of God. We shouldn't sketch out utopias, right? We should criticize and let utopias emerge organically, or even keep them as horizons without content, right? For fear of giving them too much content and making them wrong. Now, it seems like your work goes against this tendency, right, in critical theory, right? You want to give an image of the future. You want to describe something. You want to spell out an alternative, what you call multi-criterial economy. Before we go into the details of this vision, how do you justify even doing it?
I think it's a really good question, and certainly one that I've thought about a lot. And I think maybe we could start just by talking about the utopias themselves, right? Because I think that something about Marxists is that because of Marx's sort of rejection of utopian socialism, also Engels and the Second International, I think that there's been a way that although critical theorists read very widely, they tend not to read very much the utopias themselves. And I recommend reading Thomas More's Utopia. I really recommend reading it because, first of all, it's fascinating. The first book is very interesting. Marx cites it in Capital because the idea that Thomas More is living through the enclosures and he's watching all of these peasants get kicked off their land to steal in order to survive. And then they're caught up in the legal system and they're executed for stealing bread. And that is the motivation for his utopia. It's like an actual experience of the birth of capitalism. And Marx cites this in volume one, this line about the land where the sheep eat the people, you know, as a reference to the enclosures and the raising of sheep on the enclosed land. So the first book actually is it's not disconnected from society. Actually, it is a critical theory of society. It's a critical theory of what's happening in Moore's time, the experience of the origins of capitalism. And it's very interesting to know that, you know, the birth of capitalism also birthed its critique. You know, but then what Moore actually describes, and of course, is all these elements of it we can criticize, world where there are slaves. It has a kind of imperialism in relationship to other places that a utopia interacts with. And it is England, you know, it is England. It's not some fictional island. It's basically described almost exactly like, the United Kingdom. But what he talks about is a world where there's abolition of money, abolition of private property, and the birth of a non-market form of allocation. And I think that Marx draws much more on this tradition than people understand. And I'll just say a little bit more about that. So what's interesting is that when Marx was in England, there were all of these utopians drawing from Owen, Robert Owen. And Owen, although he doesn't talk about it so much in his writings, he had his disciples were very into labor notes, like labor chit exchange economy. And William Clare Roberts has written about this in Marx's Inferno. But many of Marx's, ideas gestate not out of his critique of Ricardo, but out of critiques of Ricardian socialists who are thinking about using Ricardian economics to build these true money systems, right, where money really represents a quantity of labor. And he's criticizing that. And what he turns to are these non-monetary visions of socialism. And there's a direct lineage that gets us from Thomas More, who was read by Etienne Cabet, who was one of the first people to call himself a communist. Marx emerges into this milieu of communists, all relating to and criticizing Cabet's utopias. And Cabet wrote this utopia after reading Thomas More's utopia. And then Marx, in turn, becomes a communist and uses this idea to criticize the Ricardian socialists who have this labor money system. So I think that when Marx is critical of utopian socialists, he's critical of their efforts to build too precise of a plan. But you could not have this idea that, the critique of society is about the abolition of money and private property without this, without the continuation of this Thomas More lineage against, these more monetary theories. And I think there's a very good way to read Capital to say, well, this is a critique of, it's a critique of visions of socialism. Like, it's a critique of those visions of socialism which base themselves on an inadequately theorized account of capitalism, So I think that we could say a lot more about what's at stake in the critique of the utopians, but I just want to point out that I think that Karl Kautsky wrote an entire book about this. He wrote an entire book about Thomas More as Marx before Marx, which is a great book, actually. And I think what Kautsky misses is he thinks that Thomas More arrived at these ideas and Marx arrived at the same ideas independently, because Kautsky didn't really trace through this French lineage the ways that that Karl Marx is actually drawing very directly on this Thomas More lineage to criticize the Ricardian socialists.
Mm-hmm. I mean, after Marx wrote, there was a couple other utopian novels, like, famously Edward Bellamy and William Morris. I mean, do you also see these as valuable and relevant for social theorists, for critics of capitalism to read, or are they too detailed and kind of too off base?
No, I think they're very much worth reading. And I think that whole tradition of writing, but especially those two by Bellamy.
Why those two?
Yeah. I think the thing about a lot of socialist or kind of utopias is that they predate the development of the more advanced machinery systems of capitalism. And even, I'll say, Marx predates the emergence of the modern corporation in the sort of 1890s to 1920s. And in some way, Bellamy is trying to think about that. He's trying to think about a kind of capitalism that's even more advanced than what Marx saw. Like, Marx saw it only in the railroads. Mm-hmm. And Bellamy is watching it unfold in America across all these different spaces, this kind of high concentrations of capital, economies of scale, and the implicate. Marx already begins to theorize it, but Bellamy much more. And and I think there's a lot especially to be drawn from Bellamy, who I think is closer to Marx. And I think Morris is a kind of romantic, revision, but one in which, at least in relation to what I'm interested in, keeps an idea, I think, from Marx of this kind of multi-criterial vision. So I didn't say that much about that, but I'll just digress on that for a moment. So I think that when you read Thomas More and he wants to abolish money, he's very clear that the reason to do this is that we have many goals as a society, and money cannot actually isn't a form that can allow these different aspects of society flourish. So he thinks that, for example, we should ensure everyone's security. He thinks that we should produce more durable goods and services. Like, we should have things that last. And, you know, he has also a vision of, I guess he doesn't have so much beauty, but of work time reduction. So he has this the idea is that like a socialist society, this utopia, will have goals that it needs to, like directly pursue that the money economy is unable to pursue. I think Marx also has this idea. You know, for me, the most, the section where Marx is most, like maybe it's to me, I'm sure critical theorists have a way of thinking about this, but for me, it's really in the 25th chapter of Capital, where he talks a lot about machinery and its effects on people. And he says it turns people into, you know, a fragment of a man, and it makes their work really horrible, and it, you know, creates all this precarity and insecurity. There's a set of values there. You can't think, oh, it's bad to make everyone precarious unless you believe that there should be security. And I think that these are, you know, Marx draws quite a lot on Aristotle and on Moore and on other figures to describe these values that, you know, people have and, you know, that are, of course, imminent to society. But you can't say that it's a value-free critique, you know, when he describes those aspects of capitalist development that are undermining these things that are essential to human flourishing. It is there's an implicit theory of human flourishing there, I think. And I think with Morris, you get that again. You get this real idea that that Bellamy's vision is too constrained, can't really contain all of these different goals that society would have. And that's why I think, even though it's a bit romantic, it's really worth reading. But what's very important to me now, to come back to the Bellamy and Morris thing, is that Kautsky repeats something that Marx says, which is that one of the critiques of utopianism is this idea that utopianism is something that comes before the development of the working class movement. Because the idea is that capitalism is horrible and it generates all these critical reflections and people are like, what's an alternative system? But they're just visions in the dark because there's no agent to bring them about. And the idea is that once you have this agent, people lose interest in these visions because they just want to, you know, get on with the work of bringing about the end of capitalism and creating the conditions where they can build a new society. Well, that's a prediction that Marx made, that Kautsky repeats, and it was false. Because we know that, in fact, Edward Bellamy's book was incredibly popular, much more popular than Marx's critical writings. We know that William Morris's News from Nowhere was extremely popular. And I don't just mean generally. I mean with the working class. You know, these books were very appealing. And in England, you know, the books that people read the most, in Germany, I mean, the SPD members, they were very interested in Babel's Women in Socialism, which is the most explicitly utopian, you know, it has a whole set of chapters about how communism will be organized. And, you know, Engels, socialism, you know, utopian and scientific. So people were very interested in the question of what would socialism look like. Mm-hmm. And they turned to the utopian theorists to understand that. And, you know, so this is also something Otto Neurath says that I find very important, which is that actually there was all of this interest in thinking about how to build this. And Kautsky and the other Second Internationalists followed Marx in this prediction that turned out to be wrong. And that had major consequences when after, you know, during World War I, there was all this effort, you know, there were all these revolutions and they had nothing, they had no idea. They thought there'd be time to have all these debates about what to do, but it turns out there isn't. You actually have to think about it beforehand.
Yeah, I mean, this is what Korsch talks about explicitly, and Otto Neurath too, when they talked about socialization, right? And this formula of the socialization of the means of production is kind of an empty formula that needed to be fleshed out, theorized, discussed. But yeah, there was no time. So that's why in 1919, 1920, there was just an explosion of discussion on socialization as their way of concretizing this utopian model, right, to put into practice. And there was no agreement, right? There was just debates between Hilferding, Rathenau, Kautsky, Bernstein, Neurath, Luxembourg, all of them. So yeah, I find that very fascinating. But that whole tradition, I mean, so there was a demand for utopianism. It wasn't fulfilled. It comes back after World War I, in the pre-war period, about discussions of socialization, on the future state, future economy, with the rise of the Soviet Union, there became an interest in playing again. But then when you turn more to the 30s and 40s, seeing the results of economic planning in the Soviet Union or the rise of fascism, the idea of utopia becomes kind of out of fashion again, right? So with Adorno and Horkheimer, this idea of thinking about the future while fascism is rising sounds like absurd. Why would you do that? And you can think about people making a similar argument today, right? What we need to do is be realist. We need to focus on the climate crisis, on defeating the far right. We need to focus on those things that are pressing against us right now, emergency measures. And therefore thinking about something like utopia, just, yeah, that's for kids. That's for fun. That's for play. But that's not serious social science. How do you respond to kind of this demand that we need to be realist today? Or we should stick to criticizing capitalism and its multifarious development?
Mm. I think what you said about Adorno and Horkheimer is very interesting, because I think by the 60s, there is quite a return of interest in utopia, right? And so they do manage to live through another era in which these questions naturally arise from the context of struggle. I also think that there is a problem, which is a big part of my my project, and also maybe I directly criticize William Morris on this, is that I think that there is, in spite of what some people now say in this Republican revival, like this reinterpretation of Marx through Republicanism, I think that movement associated with William Clare Roberts and, you know, Bruno Leipold, I think is very important. But I think that it overstates the case, and that Marx had this very anti-political dimension, and the utopians were often very anti-political as well. And a big feature of what that means is that they thought that there should be a kind of agreement about what society looks like after revolution. And, you know, and it comes down to the very basic things, like August Bebel says, and it's repeated by Preobrazhensky and Bukharin and the ABC of communism, this idea that, you know, and Engels also kind of says it, well, after the revolution, we'll just know how to produce everything. There won't be these questions about how to produce. It will just be, we'll just figure out what to produce and we'll know how to do it. And it's like they just misunderstand that there will be all of these political questions about how to produce things as well. And I think this ties back to the climate issue, you know, like, oh, what's the right way to produce stuff? Well, if all you care about is producing as much as possible, then maybe there is one way to produce stuff. I mean, there kind of isn't. There's all these other problems, but you could imagine at least we could figure it out. But if you also care about sustainability and you also care about workers' experience of their work, you don't want them to be so alienated and so on, like you will find that there's big questions about how to do everything. And so I think part of the ban on utopia was also about maintaining this fiction that politics would come to an end in some essential way with the end of capitalism. And, you know, I think if they had allowed more of that stuff to flourish and thought about what it meant and tried to move from a world where individuals were trying to describe with as much detail as possible, like this world where utopias means individuals saying, I think we should live like this, to saying, oh, well, there's so many different views about how we should live. So what is the form that can allow all of these different views to contest and interact with and learn from and change one another, rather than believing that, ah, well, there is one way, but it will only be discovered by proletarians after the revolution, you know? So I think that's quite problematic. But the other part of your question was just, how do I defend this idea? Well, I think that, you know, I mean, more or less, we've already said all the pieces, but just to put it more concretely, I think that especially after what happened in the Soviet Union, this idea that we can't talk about, you know, what it is to win is just ridiculous. Like we now, all those things, I mean, maybe Horkheimer and Adorno, I don't know why they take up this, you know, I'm Jewish, but I don't believe that we should import this Jewish idea of the ban on graven images into, you know, critical theory. But I think at least with regard to, and maybe it was more because of the context of fascism and so on, as you said, but I think this larger idea against doing it from Marx and the Second International, that all comes before the failure of the USSR. And I mean, you can't, once that's happened and there's all of this discrediting of the idea that socialism is possible, you can't simply say, we're not going to talk about it and it'll just be after the revolution, because, you know, it's become clear that there is nothing immediate and spontaneous about that transition. And so I think we need a very constructive theory to think about that, especially as a container for all the very different ideas people have about what that future should look like, rather than imagining we'll simply come to coherence about them. And I also think that Marx's own critical theory is much more informed by a vision of the future than critical theorists let on. And I think one of the big dangers that I see with critical theory is that you can end up criticizing features of society that, you know, that communism might not be able to resolve. There might be deep, you know, there's almost a religious aspect to believing that all the problems we can identify with our world can be resolved at this higher level. And actually, there may be many things that are just problems. We have to find ways to make them move rather than imagining that they will be resolved. I think there's a religious, maybe it's contained in this idea of the builder for boat as well, but there's a religious remnant within critical theory that actually needs to be, at least in this regard, needs to be resolved into a more scientific idea.
One thing you mentioned was this idea of politics and this idea sometimes transitioning out of capitalism means kind of the dissolution of the political state or dissolution of kind of these binaries that we're plagued with here, right? Political man, economic man, that these questions can be resolved, devolved into local levels, into spontaneous decision-making structures, into the administration of things. Now, just to move on a little bit more to your positive account, in your vision of what you call the multi-criterial economy or the post-scarcity economy or the social economy, What does politics mean to you? Right? What is the role of politics here? Does it just mean like we have like a new kind of government that can make better decisions about how to produce what we want to produce? Is it a council model in which everyone has different councils and they can produce? Like, what does politics mean to you in this vision?
Yeah, it's very interesting because I think in some way that. There's a big question about politics, which is why democracy, you know? And I think that this is a really essential question because we live in an era where everyone says, we want democratic socialism, you know, which would be the good version. There's all these bad versions out there we don't want, but the name of the good one is democratic socialism. And you just ask, like, well, what is that? What is democratic? What's democratic about it? And you'll find
vote on it.
Yeah, we vote. It's sort of like, yeah, one way to think about democratic socialism is it's the socialism obtained through an election rather than a revolution, right? But there's also many other ideas about how is democracy incorporated into socialism. And I think this tradition is at an extreme disadvantage that isn't really clearly thought through. Because I think that actually, this again comes back to this question of the, you know, anti-political character of a lot of Marxist thought is like, what needs to be decided about? Why do we need democracy? And I think that to me, many of the accounts of socialism actually don't leave very much room for democracy. And democracy mostly enters in the form of what do we want to make? Like, what should be the final list of what's produced? Mm. And the reason is that there's this long tradition of believing that, you know, all the questions of how to produce things are merely technical questions. And if that's true, then the only role for politics is to check the experts and the bureaucrats to make sure that they do not alter the technically best plan for themselves, to gain power themselves, to exploit people. So it's really about ensuring that exploitation doesn't emerge. And that's why a lot of the ideas in Marx and in Engels, in Babel, in Kautsky, and in Preobrazhensky and Bukharin's visions, it's all this idea of paying the administrators workmen's wages. It's not a political system. It's just a rotational system. And you only need it to check to make sure no one's being exploited. Mm-hmm. A lot of the councilists take on this idea too. It's just a check to make sure no one's being exploited. But again, the assumption is that what we produce may be decided, again, by, I don't know, some kind of federated council structure, but how we produce it is just, you know, it's a technical question. And they thought also, quite unfortunately, they thought it'd be a simple enough question that it could just be, you know, we could just have people rotating into these positions. And in fact, organizing production in a coherent way is an extremely difficult problem, you know, as the Soviet Union found and so on. But I think that once you realize that we have all these different goals, it implies this real question of, okay, how do we trade these goals off against them, each other? Like, there are going to be ways to make things more efficient that will come at an expense of sustainability. There are ways things more sustainable that come at a disadvantage in terms of free time or work quality. And we're going to have to figure out how to balance in any given moment these goals that we have at the level of an individual workplace, the level of a sector of the economy, at the level of the economy as a whole. And so I am proposing something like a politicization of the economy. It does break that strict boundary between economics and politics, but by politicizing the economy in terms of how we produce things, and you need structures that will allow people to decide how to make these trade-offs in a democratic way. There's no once and for all solution about them. So, you know, I think there's many ways you could do that. There's many institutional structures, and I try to describe it in a very formal way that, you know, there's a role for technical reason, which is to find the best options. And there's a role for procedural reason to choose among them. And that procedural reason should be a democratic form of reason. But there's many ways to implement democracies. I don't think it would require us to have meetings all the time. If you don't have meetings all the time, we could have some representatives. If you don't like to have representatives, we're probably going to have meetings all the time. So that's one of those things. Like, you have to decide how to handle this problem of how you deal with the fact that there's no simply aggregational way to move from what people want to decisions. You're going to have some deliberation structures. But yeah, that's what I would say is that all the ideas about how to actually democratize the economy, they tend to miss the most important problem, which is that once you take seriously the idea of a multidimensional, multi-criterial economy with many goals, you are going to have to make decisions about how to balance those goals when you can't achieve them all at the same time. And that requires true politics in the sense of we could go in different directions. There's no technical reason to pick one over the other, but it's a very meaningful choice to people which direction we go in and how we handle our problems. And so you need actual procedural democracy, democratic institutions to solve that problem.
I mean, one way values about the future are embedded in our society today is through investment. Right. So there are institutions, there are actors, there are firms that use a portion of the social surplus or the portion of their profits to invest in different lines and different goods and different products and different infrastructure for the future based on some kind of end. And they do this using kind of the market, right, or the price signal system to tell them what's cheap and what's profitable and what's not. So the market is a way of kind of mediating these investments, which are the way that values kind of get reduced to a single optimal path in the future. In your model, in your vision, investment plays a key role. It's a key lever, right? But you don't think that there is an optimal model or an optimal way to decide on these technical on these questions, right? It has to be democratized. And if you don't have a simple or a single price to tell firms what to do or a simple money system, how does investment look like?
I do think that if critical theorists are interested in the socialist calculation debate, this is really a part of it that they should pay attention to, which is that when you read Marx and Engels, they have this very simplistic understanding of investment. In fact, I think that if Marx had lived longer, he would have developed a more sophisticated account of investment because, you know, of course, that he added the section on commodity fetishism to the second edition of Capital. It wasn't there in the original one. It was added later. And what he said, he actually talks about investment there. He talks about people only read the one line about the free association of producers, but it's actually it's two paragraphs. And if you read the whole thing, he talks about how actually they will have to set aside a portion of what they produce as a social surplus to fund accumulation. And he also discusses this really much in the Critique of the Goethe Program. He says, the labor can't be paid its full value. Why? Well, because we have to set some aside for investment, and that has to be a collective process. But Marx's understanding of investment, which carries forward in the Second International, is that it's just a reproduction on an expanded scale. It's like we're producing stuff, and then we just have to multiply the amount we produce. So we have to invest to be able to do that. And what he misses is the whole entrepreneurial side of investment, that there's many proposals about how to change what we do. And you don't know in advance which ones will succeed or what will be the best. And so you have to just, people try out different, there's an experimental dimension. You know, we call it entrepreneurial because it's in capitalism, it's like the entrepreneur takes the risk and wins a monetary reward, his profit. But you could also, you know, imagine getting rid of that, but you still have to have this experimental character investment. Even if we know the right, the best technology for our moment, we don't know when a better technology will be discovered in the future. So deciding to build a lot of stuff right now might mean that, you know, we can't, we get something better a little later and we can't do it right away. We have to wait a long time. So there's all of this unknowns and uncertainty, true uncertainty in investment that makes it inherently political. Like there's just no way, you know, one of my favorite utopias is Red Star by Bogdanov, a book that contains almost no politics whatsoever. But there's one moment that's very political, which is that the Martians are running out of resources and they have to decide. I'm sorry, this is a slight spoiler, but it's just a utopia. It's, you don't have to not know what happens, but they have to decide whether to invade Venus or Earth, you know? And, you know, they decide to invade Venus, even though it's harder because it matters to them that the Earthlings might one day become communists. And but this discussion about what to do is a purely technical discussion. There's no, it's a discussion among scientists within this Martian society. And so the point is to have a theory of investment, you have to have a theory about politics, you know? And so, yeah, anyway, how is this handled in my thing? Well, it's very important that we set aside resources for investment. And you could say a way to understand what I'm saying in a more concrete way is like, look, if we get rid of the profit-based system and therefore also the whole system of exploitation that we have, you know, in capitalist society, and we set aside a social portion for the social surplus to be spent as an investment, and we don't need to generate, you know, it's a whole other story about Keynes and functional finance, but we'll leave that aside. If we're going to spend the social surplus, we can suddenly do all these things. We could, for example, say, hey, we have all these engineers, we have all these machines, we have all this capacity. We're going to build a ton of public transportation. We could say, we're going to make everything sustainable. We are going to go into everyone's job and understand what their job requires from the in our society, lowliest cleaners all the way to, and miners all the way to, you know, highly paid engineers. And we're going to say, how can we organize this job to be better? You know, we could say, look, we want our cities, we want everyone to be able to access everything they need in a 15-minute walk. We want everything to be beautiful. Like once we get rid of the profit system, we can change the world to be better in all these ways and make a world that is really a flourishing world that everyone wants to live in. Because it's not only able to use the social surplus to do things that in Marx's terms expand surplus value, in our terms maybe are focused on efficiency or something like that. Or in my terms, anyway. And so, you know, we could achieve any of this, but we have to decide how to prioritize across all these wonderful goals we could have and what order to do them in, because there's going to be path dependencies. The order we pick is going to influence the outcome. And so we have to have these democratic bodies, I think representative bodies. I say organized by sector. So, you know, there's, according to the OECD, about 20 sectors. It's like agriculture, you know, mining, utilities, education, health, business services, so on and so forth. You have to modify the OECD ones. But the idea is that each of these sectors becomes kind of self-organized as an investment board, and we bring together the workers in that sector, the people who may be firms or maybe customers who buy the things. We bring in, you know, representing the community, we bring in these technical experts, and we have all of them debating, you know, as elected representatives of different stakeholder groups, how to use the surplus in their industry. What's the way forward? What's the next most important thing in healthcare? Are we going to make more space for mental health and say mental health is as important as physical health? Are we going to say we need more clinics in rural areas? You know, we're only going to have so many resources. And so we have to figure out what to do. And there's going to be politics where people are divided about what is the next most important thing to do. And that that politics will be very creative, and it will have these experimental directions, but also very large scale planned decisions. And of course, there will have to be many decisions that can't simply be worked out in one sector, like the green transition, where you have to have like cross whole economy. So there's these bodies called coordinating committees that are tasked with like specific cross sectoral goals. But the idea is that we can build this whole world where investment actually serves human needs, but it can't serve human needs in this very simplistic technical idea. Oh, we just expand what we already have. We have to have all of this politics and experimentation to find paths forward. And so that's what I say.
So why can't we just import kind of a neoclassical economics here or rational choice theory just to say, well, you know, investment and planning in the future can just look at various options and then just see the most cost-effective one, you know? So we want to, have public transportation system in the city that make it sustainable with good jobs. So we just look at the most cost-effective one and we just go for that one. And we use kind of the basic building blocks of neoclassical economics or rational choice theory, but we do it for social ends and not for profit. We just, you know, we want to make it cost-effective given our resources and our time and our labor and our land. How come that doesn't work?
Yeah, this is a great question because it's also what I'm working on right now and what I spoke about at the at the conference, which is that I think neoclassical economics and rational choice theory is really built on this idea that we evaluate everything in this single dimension. They call it utility, but they do that because we're in a money economy. And there's this idea that everything can be valued in terms of money, right? And so if we could give the exact monetary value of every benefit that we care about, then we could say, okay, look, you know, this sustainability project will give us, you know, $1,000 of benefit per person. And this work improvement project will give us $500 of benefit per person. And we look at the relative costs and so on, and we just figure out what to do. And this is, you know, this is actually something that drives a lot of decision making in the state in capitalist economies. They do all of this, what's called cost benefit analysis. But as you can imagine, it involves deciding what all these different things are worth. And they believe that there's kind of semi-objective, they think they're really objective ways to determine exactly what anything is worth to people and to kind of aggregate all of that information and generate some general index where we can measure everything we want to do in monetary terms. And honestly, I think it's actually even on rational grounds, it just does not work, actually. It does not work for a variety of reasons. But it's just, you know, it's very hard to assign a monetary value to a wetland, you know, and then just say, okay, this is what it costs. If it's worth it to burn it, you know, to like bulldoze it or whatever, pour concrete over it, then we do it. I think that those are ways of, I think the math is very difficult to justify as objective. But even if we said, look, we're just going to do it anyway, you know, we don't care, we'll just do our best. I think that what it does is it hides from us these really essential political decisions that we have to make. Essentially, it's a kind of politics we're doing. We're assigning relative values to all these things, but in a way that I think we couldn't possibly really keep track of and understand. And I think that's why we have to, we have to treat these goals as goals for their own sake. And really think about how we want to organize them. I think it's almost like an ethical question about that, you know? Like, if we're all going to eat meat and there's going to be slaughterhouses and they're going to have all... Like, we shouldn't just, look away, you know? We should be forced to deal with the trade-offs that our choices require of us, at least at this big social level. Not in everything, but at the big level of investment. And so in order to justify that, I'm developing this kind of alternative, what I call multidimensional economics, that at its very foundation replaces this single utility function where we're just, you know, everything's measured and we say what's better or worse on the same scale with this multiple evaluative dimensions where there's, you know, we are deciding what's better or worse, but we have to say what's better or worse on grounds of sustainability, on the ground of work quality, on the ground of so on. And that will lead to a situation in which very naturally, just as a result of that, if we don't have some universal equivalent like money that we can weigh everything in terms of, what we'll find is that, you know, some options are better than others, but among the options that are choice worthy, that are rational to choose, There's no single way to like pick one out and say, ah, this is the best. So I think in order to have this future economy I'm describing, we need a robust and rigorous theory of rationality, which I think critical theorists, you know, maybe I'll leave that as like a, you know, as like a provocation. I think that the critical theorists in the tradition of Forkheimer and Adorno, they, to develop from a critical theory of the economy to a critical theory of society, they absorb all these ideas from Weber. And that's where I think they get this idea of what's called in English instrumental rationality. But in Weber, there's two forms of rationality. There's instrumental rationality and value rationality. And even in a capitalist society, values, you know, non-economic values have some effect on what happens in society. And I think that what I'm talking about is a model that really thinks of a kind of rationality that has this character, that it combines instrumental and evaluative dimensions. And that means that, you know, in such a rationality, there's no single best option anymore. And that becomes the very basis for thinking about why we need democracy, because we need these judgments. We need these dimensions where we actually decide together which dimensions to choose, which accords for the moment with the values we have.
I mean, you could imagine a model where, okay, so we're not going to use money as a general equivalent to help us filter through these choices with a cost-benefit analysis. We want to do it based on values, right? Values of what's good and what we want, maybe collective values. So why don't we just start with like a list of values or like a list of needs? You know, there's this basic needs and they're just given. We write a list of 10 and that's how we organize the future economy. Like fulfilling all these needs or fulfilling all these values. Why do you need this kind of dynamic, multi-criterial institutional structure if we can just already start with these basic needs and values?
This is one of my favorite questions. It's actually a strategy that many people are taking today. If you look at the UN or the EU or the OECD, they're all working on these models of what replaces GDP. Because even though the GDP is the category that fits most beautifully with capitalist needs, you know, the needs of capitalists and with the capitalist society, because it's a model that says all we care about is expanding income. And the way you do that is by increasing efficiency. And the way we do that is by capitalists, you know, innovating in profitable ways. And so it's this way, if you think that's what human flourishing is, then the capitalist system is the best system for doing it. We can doubt that, but I'm just saying that's their justification. But in the wider society, there's been this really big realization that actually you don't get a great society if you just focus on GDP growth. I mean, people in America many people are very unhappy, even though it's, you know, in terms of GDP, it's a very rich country per person. There's all these things that we need to live well. And so the UN tries to lay out all the different values, you know, you need. And it's all based on this work of Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum, who also developed this theory. But everybody knows that, you know, how many values do we have fundamentally? Do we have 10, 12, 15, 8? Like, there is no objective way to make that objective list, you know? There's many different ways of slicing it. And I think that partially that's because in reality, our values are very fuzzy in the boundaries, whether a given thing is one value or two, like in terms of these ethical and political values, I think we'll never be able to say. Because I think values are in some fundamental way how we justify our actions. You know, like it's a form of value rationality means that it's a justification for why we choose one path over another. And I just don't think we don't actually think in the direction from, oh, these are our values, this is what we choose. It's that, you know, we have an idea about what's the choice-worthy choice, what we should choose, and then we explain it. In some partial way, prospectively, and some partial way, retrospectively. And there's a kind of, as you will, I don't really like this term, but there's a kind of dialectic, or at least a dynamism, you know, to our values. So I think it's very important to design institutions where the main thing people have to do is choose a path. And they justify that through talking about their values, and they deliberate about their values, but we don't have to agree on our values in order to move forward. Partially, I said, for the fuzzy reason, but partially because whether we decide how many values we have and what the most important aspects are of those values, some people think sustainability just means carbon neutrality. Other people think it means also preserving biodiversity and so on. So, you have to have a system that doesn't rely on us agreeing on our values first, and that we can choose concrete options even without that agreement. It's a much more political version rather than a technocratic version, which is, I think, what the UN and EU want. But I would just also say that having this dynamic account, what's very important to me about it is it allows for the emergence of new values. Because I think we shouldn't imagine a kind of fixed set of human values. I think sustainability, you know, became in the modern era. There are all these forms of care about sustainability and indigenous communities. You know, there are all these different ideas about it, of course, very different in the past. But in the modern world, sustainability is a more recent concern, and it takes on increasing, you know, particularity and concreteness over time. You know, ideas about sexuality change, ideas about eating meat change as well, you know. So I think for all these reasons, we have to have a dynamic system that doesn't force us to fix our values in advance, but can allow our values to dynamically change and be reconceptualized and reevaluated in relationship to the concrete choices that we are presented with by the structure of these institutions.
So let's just say that I'm convinced by your perspective that I think we should have this dynamic multicultural economy where values can surface through institutions. We can break the logic of value by pluralizing our incommensurable ends and letting people decide together. That I'm okay with utopias. You know, I've lifted the ban on images. Let's just say that I agree with all that. Someone comes along and says, okay, we have the vision. How do we get there? Right. So this is the classic question of transition. This is two questions. First, do we need to have a transition plan in the first place? Right. Or is this already overstepping our boundaries? You know, don't people decide themselves how they want to get to the future? Or is this just a classical, you know, following Marx idea that, well, obviously we need working class solidarity and parties and social democracy and class struggle, class conflict to bottom up socialize the means of production, slowly take over the state and just implement this, you know, 1, 2, 3, right? Which would almost be kind of semi-technocratic, right? Like, as if you just have the thing and you just need people to do it. So is there a space for transition in this plan? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, so here, I think it's very, it is very important to have a transition plan. And I think the main reason to begin to work out all of these different accounts of like, what is this beyond capitalism we want to build is that, you know, there's this famous line from Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, where Alice is talking to Humpty Dumpty and Alice is asking for directions, and Humpty Dumpty says, well, where are you trying to go? And Alice doesn't know. And Humpty Dumpty says, well, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. And so I think, you know, part of the point of knowing where we're going is to be able to evaluate transitional programs and to come up with some, you know, maybe set but agreed upon method of transition. And I think that... you know, I say, or I want to say in this part of the project I haven't published yet, that we can't come up with a transition plan that gets us from where we are now to where we want to go, because there's a real autonomy of the political. Like, every country has a different political system, different possibilities for transformation. There's no general theory of transition, but I think there is a general theory of implementation. So we can say, you know, what should we be trying to do? Of course, there will be all these blockages along the way. Who knows? Counter-revolution, military coup, like all these problems that would be very hard to deal with. And maybe we can think about how to deal with those. But again, I think those will be specific to different places. I think that the what we can develop is like a general implementation plan that would have to be modified in specifics by country. And there, you know, I draw a lot on these, in the essays, I talk a lot about these, about Keynes and the radical Keynesians, because although I disagree with them about a lot of things, I think that they developed a theory of how we get from a monetary economy to something beyond capitalism. I disagree about what that end goal is, but I think they were very right about how to think about doing that. And, you know, for them, it occurs through creating the preconditions, which are that you have to implement these radical capital controls, you have to break the independence central bank, You have to, you know, you have to set up this national investment authority. And then you are limited in what you can do by the foreign exchange constraint, like what you need from the world and what the world needs from you, because you probably need stuff from the outside to do what you want to do. And essentially, you know, I think we can take that over. We would add, unlike them, that we want to also have a lot of taxes on the rich, expropriate, you know, a lot of wealth and so on. But I think they laid out those characteristics. And the main difference in my model is that we have to, from the beginning, have ways for this national investment authority to be already from the beginning devolving power to democratic bodies. But I think that can happen in a stepwise process. So I think, you know, there's a lot of aspects to this transition program. But in basic, I think the point is that you actually can, although it seems complicated, there are definite steps you could take to bring this about. And the point of developing a kind of model is to help us think about how we would get there if we had both the power and the sort of wide popular support and mobilization of populations to carry out these different tasks.
Is there anything that's ruled out? I mean, maybe we can't say specifically, like, you know, politically how the transition can go, because there's an autonomy to the political, as you say. But would you rule anything out in this to get from here to there?
I think it's very interesting. Like, I was following very much the social struggles in Bangladesh. And, you know, it's actually a democratic country with elections, but like many democratic countries, has a lot of corruption. People don't feel like their governments represent them, you know. And there was a social revolution that brought these students to power. And I think, you know, I think it's totally legitimate to think that, you know, better that one comes to power in a democratic system, and you need to think about, you know, having a program and having that be something that that is you fight for within a parliamentary system. But I think you have to recognize that a lot of social change happens in crises and things that are not, expected or anticipated or ratified by the constitutional parliamentary order. I think even, for example, in the EU, you know, the EU has a constitution, but it's experienced over many years many crises that led to the development of new institutions and that led to, you know, all of these unexpected emergency measures that were not, you know, exactly justified procedurally. You know, I don't think you're going to have like a bunch of riots that implement the transition out of capitalism or anything. But I do think that the most important thing is to plan a democratic election-based transition and to think very thoughtfully about how in moments of real contestation it might be possible to push this stuff, you know, in that context. But yeah, I think it's a difficult question.
Do you see any, just as we're coming to our end here, you know, given the political context in which we live, you know, with Trump in power, or with climate change not being taken seriously by so many people, or rising AfD in Germany, or far right politics coming in Latin America, do you see possibilities for realizing, implementing, transitioning beyond capitalism still viable today? Or is this a message in a bottle to the next generation?
No, on the contrary. I think our times are very contradictory. And I think that, you know, I think people forget that the periods when there was the biggest push to change the world, you know, was 1917 to 1919 or 1921 maybe. And, you know, 1945 to 47, 48. Maybe 49. And those periods were periods when people thought they were living through the end of the world. You know, they thought they were living through the apocalypse. And I think that, you know, when there are big possibilities of social change, you're going to see very hardcore radical right-wing movements that are going to have many resources and try to take power, even though they have no, you know, they have no realistic plan for solving our problems. The idea that it's horrible ethically and politically, but you think you're going to solve the problems by not having immigrants come to the country? I mean, I just don't think that these are actual solutions. I think they are spectacular slogans, very dangerous ones. But I don't think that the far right has any real solutions to the problems that we face. And I think that just focusing on criticizing them is an insane policy. And I think Neurath, you know, Otto Neurath, who I look to quite a lot, would agree here. The idea that you're going to stop, you know, these horrible things from happening by criticizing what they're doing and offering no other idea about what to do, not having a constructive vision of a better world, I just think you will lose. Because I don't think that there's never been a period where socialists have come to power by claiming to be anti-capitalists or anti-fascists. That is very important to be those things. But you don't come to power by criticism. You come to power by constructive ideas, things that people can believe in. And I just think that that's very, I think especially in times like this, very important to think about it. And I also think that, you know, as was true in those eras, as we already mentioned a bit about the socialization, you know, debates and so on, if you don't have an idea about what to do, then you will miss your chance. You cannot but miss a chance to win if you don't know what it would mean to win, you know, in advance. And so it's very important to think about it. And I think maybe I'm too optimistic. I think there's many horrible things happening, but I do think that we will see a revival, and especially if you look outside of the West and you look to South Asia and so on, you see this, you know, amazing South Asian spring, very similar to the Arab Spring. And so I think that there's many reasons to be hopeful and to plan and I'm also very, I'm just very, edified by the incredible expansion of interest in this problem, you know, in the population. So I think that in itself kind of bodes well in some very minor way for the future.
Now, your texts are sketches of the future. They're kind of proposals, they're provocations. What do you hope people do with them? Like what would be in your world the best reception of these texts? Would it be like, what would people add to them or criticize in them? How could they engage with them?
Yeah, I think that they are provocations, as you said. It'd be great to have a debate. You know, I'm hoping eventually to set up some kind of space where people who have, you know, they don't have to agree with me about the details, but who agree with some broad outlines of the approach, you know, that we would think really seriously about these things. And again, you know, my whole position is that there is no, I'm not, you know, writing recipes for the cookshops of the future. I'm just trying to say what the cookshop could look like, you know? And I think that we don't need we don't need to all agree on that. It would be better if there were multiple versions that share a family resemblance to one another in some way. So I would really like to have a space where we could say, hey, you know, you could organize investment this way, or this way. You could organize, you know, these different parts of it. Here are different ideas, different sketches. And to try to build out a kind of a framework for thinking about the different pieces and the problems that my institutions are made to solve, maybe other ways to do it. And also on the transition question, to come up with different implementation programs, to be very serious about figuring out how to do it. Because I think you wouldn't want, you know, I certainly wouldn't want anyone to just take my vague ideas that I've worked on and say, ah, this is what we're going to do. You know, I think they require quite a lot of reflection to figure out. And again, that there should be multiple versions of those things. And so, yeah, I think it'd be great to have a new socialist calculation debate to figure out, you know, what the future should look like. And I'm ready. And I'm hopeful for the criticisms because I want to sharpen my critical tools, constructive tools.
I have a suggestion for the name for this institute.
Ah.
The Cookshop. Aaron Beninov, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Critical Theory in Context.